TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Ira Helfand and Alan Robock. Nuclear Blast and Nuclear Winter. How Nuclear War Will Kill the Attacker as Well as the Attacked. Dr. Ira Helfand explains what happens when a nuclear weapon hits the center of an American city. Professor Alan Robock is the leading expert on nuclear winter. He says that the firestorm of the burning city raises a cloud of dust into the stratosphere, where it circles and eventually covers the globe for up to a decade. Even a limited nuclear war using less than 1% of the existing weapons will bring darkness and famine to the Northern Hemisphere. A U.S. president threatening casually fire, fury, and power the likes of which this world has never seen before displays ignorance of nuclear physics as well as of Republican politics. When Ronald Reagan, in the middle of his Cold War campaign against the Soviet Union, suddenly showed interest in meeting Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev to talk about the reduction of nuclear weapons, the world took notice. Later, Reagan and Gorbachev made a joint statement. They said, "Nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought." What is it like when a city is hit by a nuclear weapon? Dr. Ira Helfand is co-president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. IPPNW is a nonpartisan federation of national medical groups in 64 countries. They represent tens of thousands of doctors, medical students, health workers, and concerned citizens. And they share the common goal of creating a world free from the threat of nuclear annihilation. Dr. Ira Helfand is one of their acclaimed speakers. He was recorded at Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston in April 2016.
We're all familiar with the image of Hiroshima after the nuclear bombing there. And we have to understand this is not what the world will look like after modern nuclear war. Hiroshima was one small bomb, about 15 kilotons, 15,000 tons of TNT. A modern attack on a city like Boston would involve not one bomb, but perhaps 10 or 12, each of them anywhere from 10 to 50 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. It's difficult to describe 10 or 15 bombs going off all at the same time, so I'm going to use a model of a single explosion, a single 20 megaton bomb, 20 million tons of TNT. The megatonnage is actually a little bit bigger than would probably fall on Boston. The destruction that I'm going to describe is actually an underestimate because you cause more damage by spreading out the bombs over more efficiently over a large area. But I think it gives an adequate understanding of the magnitude of the danger that we face. So a 20 megaton bomb going off over the State House in downtown. Within 1/1000th of a second, a fireball would form, reaching out for 2 miles in every direction, engulfing everything, including the building we're sitting in a fireball, which the temperatures within this would rise to up to 20 million degrees Fahrenheit, which is hotter than the surface of the sun, and everything would be vaporized. The buildings, the people, the trees, the upper level of the Earth itself would disappear. To a distance of 4 miles in every direction, the blast would generate overpressures of 25 pounds per square inch and winds in excess of 600 miles per hour. Mechanical forces of that magnitude could destroy anything that people can build. Underground shelters collapse when they're exposed to pressures this great. To a distance of 6 miles in every direction, the heat would be so intense that automobiles would melt. To a distance of 10 miles in every direction, the winds would still be greater than 200 miles per hour. The blast pressure is still greater than 10 pounds per square inch. Forces of that magnitude will level masonry buildings, wooden frame buildings. A building like this would see the walls and the floors swept out. there'd be a steel skeleton left behind. To a distance of 16 miles in every direction, the heat would still be so intense that everything flammable would burn. Paper, cloth, gasoline, wood, heating oil, plastic, it would all ignite, causing hundreds of thousands of fires, which over the next half hour would coalesce into a firestorm, 32 miles across, covering over 800 square miles. Within this entire area, the temperatures would rise to 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. All of the oxygen would be consumed, and every living thing would die. In the case of Boston, we're talking about something on the order of 3 million people dead in a half an hour. Beyond this firestorm, the destruction would continue. To a distance of 19 miles, people standing outside would suffer third-degree burns on any exposed skin. To a distance of 21 miles, second-degree burns. To a distance of 40 miles, people who turned reflexly to look at the sudden flash of light would be blinded. There would be hundreds of thousands of casualties, all kinds of injuries. People blinded, as I mentioned. People made deaf by having their eardrums ruptured. People suffering penetrating wounds as shards of glass flew through the air. People with mechanical injuries and crush injuries from being thrown themselves through the air or being trapped under collapsing buildings. And most especially, there would be people with burns. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people with major burn injuries. They would all need urgent medical attention, and that care would not be available. In the entire United States, there are about 2,000 burn beds. Here in the Boston area, there are three institutions, between them 46 burn beds for hundreds of thousands of patients. And all three of these facilities are in the zone of complete destruction. In fact, almost all of the hospitals in the metropolitan area would be destroyed. Most of the doctors would be dead. Most of the nurses would be dead. There'd be no electricity to power EKG machines, X-ray machines. What little supplies were not destroyed, blood products, antibiotics, pain medicine, would be used up in the first minutes of dealing with this catastrophe. There'd be no EMS system to transport people to hospitals. And in fact, the vast majority of the people who were injured would also die. And if this attack were part of a large-scale war between the United States and Russia, this same level of destruction would be visited on every major city in both countries. A study which we published in 2002 showed that if only 300 of the 1,500 warheads that the Russians maintain on hair trigger alert hit urban targets in the United States, 75 to 100 million people would be dead in the first half hour. In addition, the entire economic infrastructure of the country would be destroyed. All the things that we depend on to maintain our population. We're not hunter-gatherers or subsistence farmers. We need an intact society to live, and that society would be gone. The internet would be gone, the electric grid, the public health system, the food distribution system. None of this would exist anymore. And it is probable that in the months following this nuclear war, the vast majority of the American and Russian people who did not die in the initial attack would also die from exposure, from starvation, from radiation poisoning, from epidemic illness. All told, perhaps 500 million people. And as my colleague, Professor Robuck, will explain in his talk, these direct effects are only a part, and incredibly enough, only a small part of the damage that will be caused by nuclear war. So why talk about this? Well, for two reasons. First, because if we do not take action, this is the future that will be. This is going to happen. We've been told for 25 years that we don't need to worry about nuclear war between the United States and Russia. Well, even during that period, we knew that there could be an accident. And there have been at least five occasions since the early 1980s when either Moscow or Washington prepared to launch nuclear war in the mistaken belief that it was already under attack. But in the last two or three years, we've also come to understand that the assurances we received that deliberate nuclear war between the US and Russia was impossible, those assurances were hollow. The crisis in Ukraine has made it clear that the United States and Russia could end up on opposite sides of a military conflict. And since that crisis began, there's been unbelievable nuclear saber rattling on both sides. The Russians have threatened repeatedly to use nuclear weapons in response to this crisis, and NATO, for its part, has conducted military exercises very close to Russian borders using nuclear-capable forces. It is an extremely dangerous situation, and has led leaders on both sides to warn that the danger of nuclear war today is greater than at any time in the past, greater than it was during the 1980s. That's one reason why we need to talk about this. The other and more important reason is that this is not the future that must be. We don't have to go down this route. Nuclear weapons are not a force of nature. They're not an act of God. We've built them with our own hands, and we know how to take them apart. All that has been missing is the political will to do this. This is a tremendous responsibility. It is a huge burden that sits on our shoulders. We are literally responsible for the fate of the Earth. But if this is a great burden, I think it is also something of a gift that has been given to us. Every one of us wants to do something good with our life. We have been given the opportunity to save the world, and that is a very good thing to do. It says in Deuteronomy, it's reported in Deuteronomy, that God said, "Behold, I have put before you life and death. Therefore, choose life, that you and your children might live." That is literally the choice before us today, before all of humanity. And so let us, in our work today, dedicate ourselves to choosing wisely and to acting with courage and determination so that indeed our children might live. I want to thank you for coming to this meeting. This is a difficult topic to talk about. It's a difficult way to spend a day. But even more, I want to thank you for the work which I know you're going to do after today. No one of us is expected to do this job all by ourselves, but every one of us is expected to do that part of the job which falls to us to do. And that is our individual responsibility in this situation. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Ira Helfand. He's co-president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. For almost 30 years, they have campaigned to abolish nuclear weapons. Along with Helen Caldicott's organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility, they have moved many to understand the effects of nuclear weapons on human beings and the world. In February 2015, Dr. Helen Caldicott organized a symposium on the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction. One of the presenters was Professor Alan Robock. He spoke on nuclear famine and nuclear winter, climatic effects of nuclear war. He is part of my introduction to the original broadcast. Ever since the astrophysicist Carl Sagan coined the term of nuclear winter in 1983, an additional global risk became evident. Even a limited nuclear exchange would pose a grave danger to all life. If it was not by nuclear blast, fire, and radiation, it would be by nuclear winter. High-altitude dust clouds that spread through the stratosphere can block the sun for years and even decades over large areas of the planet and threaten the global ecology and with it the sources of food. In retrospect, two factors played a huge role in steps on the road to limit and abolish nuclear weapons: a vibrant anti-nuclear movement and scientists who had the courage to speak out. And Alan Robock, today's speaker, is one of them. Looking back at the 1980s, scientists then were supported by one of the largest and effective social movements in modern time. Some claim that in the U.S. by numbers, it exceeded the civil rights movement. Some say that the test ban treaties and the reduction of nuclear weapons would never have happened unless there had been a decade-long period of activism beginning way before the 1980s. And it was an international campaign. In the UK, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, was founded in 1957 in the wake of widespread fear of nuclear conflict and the radiation dangers of nuclear tests. Professor Alan Robock was one of the acclaimed speakers at the symposium on the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction, organized by Dr. Helen Caldicott. Here is Helen Caldicott. She introduces Alan Robock.
The next speaker is Alan Robock, Distinguished Professor of Climate Science in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. His areas of expertise include climatic effects of nuclear war, effects of volcanic eruptions on climate, and soil moisture variations. His honours include being a Fellow of the American Geophysical Union, the American Meteorological Society, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Professor Robock is a lead author of the 2013 Working Group of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Alan Robock.
Thanks very much, Helen, for inviting me. So here's our beautiful planet. But after a nuclear war, it might look like this, with a cloud of smoke covering the Earth, blocking out the sun and making it cold and dark at the Earth's surface. There are two types of targets, ground bursts, and so the cities would burn and firestorms would build. Ground bursts also produce dust, and in one case, the sunlight gets absorbed. In another case, it gets reflected, but that means very little sunlight would reach the ground, and that would cause rapid large drops in surface temperature. This would be devastation to agriculture and natural ecosystems. The smoke in the atmosphere also heats the upper atmosphere, which then destroys ozone, and that would mean a lot more ultraviolet radiation reaching the ground, also which would be devastating for life. So this produces what we call nuclear winter, with cold, dry, dark conditions at the surface, more ultraviolet, producing crops dying and global famine. The first idea of this was by a paper by Paul Crutzen and John Birks, and then climate model simulations of the response were done by both Russians, Alexandrov and Stenchikov, and Americans, Turco et al. And I published a paper the next year showing the long-term effects. And the nuclear freeze movement was going on at the same time. And then the nuclear arms race ended. And this science was part of the story of why the nuclear arms race ended. The Soviet Union ended 5 years later, so it wasn't the end of the Soviet Union that ended the arms race. I'd also like to point out that the number by 2017 is not zero. We still will have 5,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, and that's still enough to produce nuclear winter. So the problem has not been solved. Why do I think we scientists had a role? Well, you can ask the people that made the decision, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. Reagan said, a great many reputable scientists are telling us such a war could end up in no victory for anyone because we'd wipe out Earth as we know it. If you think back to natural calamities back in the last century, in the 1800s, volcanoes, we saw the weather so changed there was snow in July in many temperate countries. And they call it the year in which there was no summer. Now, if one volcano can do that, what are we talking about with the whole nuclear exchange, the nuclear winter the scientists are talking about? It's possible. And Gorbachev said models made by Russian and American scientists showed a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter that could be extremely destructive to all life on Earth. The knowledge of that was a great stimulus to us. So both these men who made the decision had this information from both Russian and American scientists telling them the same story. That was a powerful message. So that was 30 years ago. Why am I even telling you about it? I want to ask two questions. The Cold War and the arms race are over. Could the remaining nuclear arsenal still produce nuclear winter with temperatures below freezing? And now there are not just two nuclear nations, there are nine. What if a couple of the new nuclear nations, say India and Pakistan, had a war on the other side of the world? How would that affect us? So the answers to these questions are yes, the current arsenal can still produce a nuclear winter, and will last much longer than we thought, decades. And a small nuclear war would not produce winter, that is, the temperatures wouldn't get below freezing, but it would be terrible direct effects, and there would be severe impacts on global agriculture for more than a decade. Now, unfortunately, we know that cities can burn. There was an earthquake in San Francisco in 1906, and Jack London was out on San Francisco Bay. He wrote, within an hour after the earthquake, the shock of the smoke of San Francisco's burning was a lurid tower visible 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this lurid tower swayed in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. And it produced a firestorm and pumped the smoke up into the upper atmosphere. All the buildings were gone except for some of the stone ones. This is what one of the survivors of Hiroshima remembers, which is the smoke and the fires. So we have this example of cities burning and producing smoke. There are about 16,400 nuclear weapons in the world now, as of August 2014. Russia has about 8,000, the U.S. about 7,000. All these other countries have a couple hundred. Why did they stop? Why did they only have a couple hundred? How many nuclear weapons do you have to put on your enemy to deter them from attacking you? One. Okay, maybe two if the first one doesn't work. So why do we still have thousands? I mean, the U.S. and Russia could immediately go down to 200 each and not lose any of their deterrent ability, even if it were a deterrent. Now, Max talked about, Ted also, about how close we've come several times. What about this time? Imagine you're Pakistani air defense and you see an attack coming in over the horizon. And you're a nuclear nation. Who do you think would be attacking you? Would you guess it was the United States, or maybe you'd think it was India? So did we almost start a nuclear war by going to get Osama bin Laden? We didn't, fortunately. But along the Kashmir border, there are always disputes between Indians and Pakistanis. Imagine a skirmish there escalating due to poor communication, misunderstanding, panic, problem with the computer. In fact, the last year I was at the IPPNW meeting in Kazakhstan, and I picked up the newspaper that morning in the hotel. Four people were killed when nuclear-armed rivals India and Pakistan traded heavy fire across the border early Saturday. This happens all the time. We've been really lucky that this, again, hasn't escalated into something worse. So we decided to look at what the climatic effects of such a war would be. So we took 50 Hiroshima-sized weapons and put them on the 50 targets in each country that would produce the largest amount of smoke. And for India, this would produce 3.5 million tons of smoke. For Pakistan, 3 million, 6.5 million. We said, let's be conservative. Let's put 5 million tons of smoke into the upper atmosphere and see what the climate response would be. This is much less than 1% of our current global nuclear arsenal. 0.03%. Of course, it would be a terrible direct effect. 20 million people would die directly. So here's a movie of where the smoke would go, and most of it would be heated and go up into the stratosphere, the region above where there's weather, so there wouldn't be any rain to wash it out, and it would last for more than a decade, and it would cover the whole world. If you graph the climate response on a graph of global average temperature, so it would be a couple degrees colder. It wouldn't be winter temperatures, but this would be the climate change unprecedented in recorded human history, colder than the Little Ice Age. Now, two other climate models have recently done a similar calculation to make sure this is not dependent on one climate model. All three found basically the same result. This is the climate model at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is a much more detailed and also includes the effects of ozone. Our first calculation showed that the temperature would go down by, you know, 1.5 degrees Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And the Swiss model showed similar results. The NCAR model had the smoke last longer. It calculated in more detail in the stratosphere, and actually it would last for a couple decades. All right, so a couple degrees. What does that mean? So we said, let's take this and let's go to places where they grow food and apply the change of temperature, the change of precipitation, the change of sunlight, and calculate how crops would grow. First of all, the ozone would be depleted, and so now we worry about the ozone hole around Antarctica. This would be a global ozone hole with excess ultraviolet, and we haven't even had time yet to look at the impacts of the UV. All of those three climate models, looking at how the production of the main food crops in China, the country that grows the most food, would change. And so this is for 10 years, And for rice, it would be down by 20%. For winter wheat, 40%. And this is only in the first decade. So let me summarize this. In the U.S., corn would go down by 20%, soybeans 15%, rice would go down by 25%, and wheat by 40%. And it would last for more than a decade. And so you can imagine people hoarding food, world food trade collapsing. So what's new in this work? A nuclear war between any nuclear states using much less than 1% of the current nuclear arsenal could produce climate change unprecedented in recorded human history. Such a, quote, small nuclear war could reduce food production by 20 to 40% for a decade. So what are the policy implications then? Immediate American and Russian reductions of to the same arsenals of the other nuclear nations, about 200 each, would prevent nuclear winter. We wouldn't be able to produce enough smoke to actually cause temperatures to go below freezing and sentence the entire world to famine. But if we want to prevent the famine that would result, maybe a billion people would die from a war between India and Pakistan because of the cutting the food supply, then we have to get rid of all the nuclear weapons. Now, Carl Sagan, who was one of the leaders about talking about this in the 1980s, said, "For myself, I would far rather have a world in which the climatic catastrophe cannot happen, independent of the vicissitudes of leaders, institutions, and machines. This seems to me to be elementary planetary hygiene, as well as elementary patriotism." So elementary planetary hygiene demands that we eliminate the nuclear weapons much faster than they're being eliminated now. I'll just end with another quote from Dr. Seuss. "Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing's going to get better. It's not." Thanks.
That was Alan Robach. He's an American climatologist and currently teaches in the Department of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. He's an IPCC lead author and was a member of the organization when it was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. You heard a TUC radio special in response to the threatened use of nuclear weapons. Ira Helfand and Alan Robach, Nuclear Blast and Nuclear Winter. Nuclear war will kill the attacker as well as the attacked. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.